Good morning. A government shutdown is over. A fight over health insurance premiums is not. Who are some of the people facing drastically higher prices in the coming year? We hear their voices in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump campaigned on making things cheaper. In polls, though, most voters say he's making things worse. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Treasury Secretary says one way to lower grocery prices would be to cut some of Trump's tariffs. Also, are immigrants migrating away from cities with high-profile immigration enforcement? It's Thursday, November 13th. On this day in 1775, American troops captured Montreal from the British. The takeover didn't last. Redcoats forced them to flee, and Canada did not become part of the new United States. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The historic federal government shutdown has come to an end. The House passed the short-term spending bill last night. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports President Trump signed it soon after.
President Trump signed the bill in a late-night ceremony from the White House, where he continued to blame the Democrats for the shutdown.
This was an easy extension, but they didn't want to do it the easy way. They had to do it the hard way, and they looked very bad, the Democrats do.
The package funds most of the government through the end of January, but also includes 3 years of funding for some other programs, including agriculture and military. The legislation also includes a provision that would reverse layoffs of federal workers that were made during the shutdown and ensure retroactive pay for those who were furloughed. And Trump again pressed to end the Senate's filibuster rule that requires 60 votes to bring legislation to the floor. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
With the House back in session, Speaker Mike Johnson swore Arizona Democratic Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva into office. Her oath-taking was delayed for 50 days. That also delayed action on a discharge petition intended to force a House vote. This demands the full release of files on late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Grijalva spoke immediately after taking her oath.
I will sign the discharge petition right now to release the Epstein files.
Her signature provides a majority for the petition. Speaker Johnson says he'll hold that vote next week. This came on the day Democrats and then Republicans on the House Oversight Committee released emails from Epstein's estate. Some emails raise new questions about his ties to President Trump. The White House says the emails prove nothing and were released by Democrats in an effort to smear the president. Even though the government shutdown is over, air travel is still reduced. The government has cut flights in the U.S. by 6%. That is until enough air traffic controllers are able to return to work. The U.S. Mint says it has stopped making pennies after producing them for more than 200 years. NPR's Rafael Nam says the last penny coin was minted in Philadelphia.
The end of this tiny little coin had already been announced by President Trump back in February. Producing each penny was costing the U.S. government nearly 4 cents, and ending production would save the U.S. more than $50 million a year. But the move to phase out the penny has been a big pain for many retailers and banks, which are struggling to provide exact change. After all, pennies remain legal tender, meaning that they can still be used. Chances are, though, many of them will stay where they've probably been for years, in big jars, coffee cans, or somewhere under the cushion of your couch. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
This is NPR. Civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson has been hospitalized in Chicago. His organization, the Rainbow Push Coalition, says he is being treated for a neurodegenerative condition. It's called progressive supranuclear palsy. The group says he has been managing PSP for more than a decade. Jackson is 84. Missouri National Guard troops are being deployed to assist ICE agents in that state. Missouri's largest black police union is objecting. Members fear the deployment could break trust with communities of color. From St. Louis Public Radio, Andrea Henderson has more.
Early last month, Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe authorized troops to help ICE agents with clerical duties as arrests spike under the Trump administration. Donnie Walters leads the Ethical Society of Police, St. Louis's Black Police Union. He says the heavy-handed tactics from federal agents and troops seen in some cities across the country makes him worry about what happens after they leave.
Let's say they come in for 6 weeks. And whatever they're doing, when they leave, we now are left with the fallout.
Walter says sending in more troops and ICE agents doesn't reduce crime. Job training and equal access to education and housing does. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Henderson in St. Louis.
The robo-taxi company Waymo says it's going to expand its service to include freeways and interstates. The driverless taxis will offer this service in Los Angeles, Phoenix, and San Francisco. Waymo's greatly expanded service in the Bay Area down to San Jose. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
May 5th, 1945. It was a beautiful Saturday as Pastor Archie Mitchell headed to Fremont National Forest in South Central Oregon for a little fishing and a picnic. With him were his pregnant wife and his Sunday school class. Among those five students were Jane and Joe Patsky, a sister and brother whose family had relocated from Cass Lake, Minnesota. In a few days, World War II would be over in Europe. What a relief. The Patskys had lost an older brother in Germany. And hopefully, the Pacific War would end soon, too. While the pastor parked, his wife and the kids ran into the woods, where Jane Patsky spotted an innocent-looking balloon caught in a tree. Someone tugged the rope and set off an explosion. The Japanese government had floated thousands of these balloon bombs to America's west coast to create havoc among its wartime enemy. The pastor ran towards the explosion, but no one had survived.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We can expect heavy traffic during the morning rush today here in Washington, D.C.
Here in Los Angeles and other cities, it's fair to expect the parking lots at federal buildings to fill up. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are ending their furloughs after Congress voted to reopen the government. What's not over is the uncertainty that 22 million Americans face about their health insurance payments. And in a moment, we'll hear the voices of some of the people affected.
A debate over health insurance subsidies continues, so let's begin our coverage with NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunn. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What, if anything, did we get out of a 43-day shutdown?
Well, not a whole lot. This bill funds some agencies through the end of next September, notably funds SNAP, which provides food assistance to nearly 1 in 8 Americans. The bill includes measures that reverses some layoffs the Trump administration imposed during the shutdown, provides back pay for federal employees, and puts in some protections against further layoffs. But the central issue underlying the entire shutdown, the reason that most Democrats didn't vote over a month ago to fund the government in the first place, did not get addressed. And that's the extensions of the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies that are set to expire at the end of the year.
Which we've heard a lot about from Democrats on this program and elsewhere. I was just watching a video of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is furious about what she sees as cowardice by the Senate Democrats who broke with their party and decided to make this deal. Fierce criticism. What is the reasoning of the people who decided to end the shutdown, though?
I think it came down to acknowledging that the cost of the shutdown was very high and there was no end in sight. You know, let's talk about the realities on the ground here. Real impacts on people, tens of millions of Americans not getting the food aid they rely on, air traffic controllers, TSA agents, millions of federal workers going without pay. From the beginning, Senate Democrats said they would hold out on voting to fund the government until Republicans came to the table to negotiate on those subsidies. Senate Republicans repeatedly said they're open to that, but only after the government was funded, not before. And this is all taking place at a time when the Democratic base is really calling for a strong opposition party. You know, I hear a lot from Democrats about wanting to see the party fight back against the Trump administration. And when you're in the minority, there's not a whole lot you can do. Trying to use the shutdown as some form of leverage is one of the things that the party in the minority can do. But at the end of the day, it just didn't work. Republicans weren't budging.
Okay, you told me that Republicans say they are open to extending the ACA subsidies after the government is reopened, which it now is, but I know there's also a lot of Republicans who are skeptical of the whole idea. So is it a win for Democrats to get an assured vote on this in the Senate, at least?
Well, many Democrats don't think so. You know, the result is an end to the shutdown that doesn't address this core demand, and Democrats are left kind of defending the handshake agreement that they once said was insufficient. Not to mention, even if a bill addressing the subsidies passes the Senate, it still needs to go to the House, and getting it to pass in the House is another kettle of fish. So, you know, I've heard a lot of critics say that the Democrats who voted to end the shutdown shouldn't have caved, to borrow their language. But the Democrats who voted for this bill say that their initial strategy as a party ended up just not being effective, and waiting a little or a lot longer wasn't going to change that. The only thing that it does change is how long the American people keep suffering from the effects of the shutdown.
Well, what are you watching now that we move toward this vote in December on the subsidies?
Well, looking to see how Senate Democrats craft a bill to address the subsidies. Can they do it in a way that brings enough Republicans on board? If they're successful, they'll start the year with a policy victory. And if Republicans don't support it, Democrats still have what they say is a winning issue, health care, to campaign on.
And that's NPR's Barbara Sprunt. Barbara, thanks for getting up early. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
People who buy insurance on federal marketplaces are seeing much higher premiums. Chris O'Donnell says his family's cost is expected to go up by $1,300 per month.
With my wife's diabetes and also her being a cancer survivor, not having insurance is just completely out of the question. I do have enough income that by not putting any money aside for retirement next year, I can redirect that money towards the insurance premium.
O'Donnell is 57 years old, and he and his wife are seriously considering retirement in another country where healthcare costs are more stable.
Jenna Boatwright lives in the North Woods of Wisconsin in a town called Siren.
I don't really know what my coverage will look like other than the preliminary numbers are showing that without the tax credit, it will be a 100% increase. And that I absolutely cannot afford.
Boatwright is 40 and has an aggressive case of rheumatoid arthritis.
And I do worry that without insurance and the care of specialty and the medication that I'm on, how quickly I will become disabled. And that's an absolutely terrifying prospect.
Ezra McKay is in his 20s, works part-time as a bookseller in Memphis, and has liked his insurance up to now.
All of my prescriptions are covered, and a lot of my doctor's visits are covered too, which has just been such a relief over the last year. It's just kind of made me feel like important and valid, like I deserve to exist or something like that.
Without the subsidy, his premium goes from $15 per month to $550, nearly half his monthly income.
Which matters to Mr. McKay because he has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
I would be in an extremely bad situation of having difficulty maintaining my job, maintaining my house, maybe even having a life-threatening situation if I were to have a mental health crisis due to being unmedicated.
He says he is considering moving to California or Washington State, where state programs offer more secure coverage.
So can Democrats and Republicans come to an agreement on extending those expiring COVID-era Affordable Care Act subsidies? For more on that political fight, we've called Jonathan Cohn. He's a senior national correspondent for conservative news site The Bulwark. He's also the author of The 10-Year War, Obamacare, and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. Jonathan, so we just heard that the next big question is whether Democrats in the Senate can come up with a bill that'll pass with at least a handful of Republican senators. Do you see any option out there that could get enough support?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it for the reasons your correspondent just was laying out. If there were an easy agreement here, we'd have it by now. But I do think the underlying reality, we were just listening to it. All these people who don't have health insurance are going to have trouble paying for their health insurance because these expiring subsidies go away. And, you know, they are disproportionately in Republican districts, in Republican states. That has not changed. That is going to put pressure on Republican legislators to come to the table and try to find a way to do something about this.
So based on what you just said, then, are Republicans viewing that as a priority at all, that one that maybe they could be or should be solving?
It depends on which Republicans you're talking about. Obviously, Speaker Mike Johnson, no, it's very clear he does not want to do this. But, you know, there are Republican members of the House who are interested. Don Bacon from Nebraska has actually a proposal out there. There are a number of Republican senators who have talked about it. And they are talking about it because they're reacting to their constituents, and they can read the polls as well as anybody. They know this does not look good for their party to have this giant premium increase going. So there's some appetite there. Whether you can get from that appetite to an agreement, obviously, is a whole other question.
But the big Republican option, at least some Senate Democrats, are open to extending those expiring subsidies in exchange for stricter restrictions on abortion. And that's something for Democrats that seems to be a non-starter. So are we right where we started from already?
They would have to resolve the abortion issue, and that's one of several that I think could get in the way. That I think is a non-starter for the Democrats. I think that the easy way to think about this is, I think Democrats are open. This is my guess. You can imagine a deal where the Democrats have to settle for half a loaf. They can't get all the extension they want. It can't, not quite as much money, maybe not as many years. Where I don't think they're going to be open for business is on anything that undermines or pulls back on the Affordable Care Act. They're happy to, I can see negotiations over what this extension looks like. I do not see any negotiations where part of the deal is we're going to start to dismantle this law that the Republicans call Obamacare.
Now, does President Trump need to get directly involved somehow in this issue to get something done?
I would assume so. I mean, for a negotiation like this to come through in normal times, the president has to be deeply engaged, has to be the convener, has to bring the people together. I think that's even more so in this case because we know House Republicans, and again, I think that's where the sticking point's going to be because, Senate seems maybe like an easier deal. They're not going to vote, yes, unless, Speaker Johnson allows a vote. And in general, they're going to take their cues from Trump. So, I mean, he's got to get engaged. He's got to be pushing this. And, one could say maybe that's the biggest obstacle because so far he has not.
Why do you think President Trump hasn't ever really been able to articulate a plan? Because he's always talked about repealing and replacing Obamacare. But then when he's asked about a plan, he never seems to have much to say.
Yeah. So is there a basic contradiction here between what he says he wants, what he says he wants to deliver and the whole Republican Party says they want to deliver and what their actual plans would do? I mean, there's a fundamental divide in this country. Democrats want to get to universal coverage. They think the government should be heavily involved in guaranteeing health care for everyone. Republicans do not believe that. It's a principled fight, right? I mean, this is what we liberal and conservative fight we've had over the generations. But the problem is people like health care. So, Donald Trump says, we're going to give you great health care, cheap health care for everybody, and it's going to be better than, the Affordable Care Act. Well, they don't actually have plans that do that. They have plans that cut government health care plans. They cut Medicare. They cut subsidies. And, from their standpoint, it's great. It's less government spending. You can put that money into tax cuts. But it does always mean there's, millions of people are going to lose insurance if you do one of those plans. And there's not going to be protections for people with pre-existing conditions. So that's a contradiction. And he can't solve that any more than anyone else can.
Just a few seconds, Jonathan. Do you think centrist Democrats gave up their leverage by ending this shutdown now?
My personal opinion is they had a little more of a hand to play out on this. I think, but there's still more of this game to be played.
Jonathan Cohn is a senior national correspondent for conservative news site The Bulwark. Jonathan, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
PR comes from this station and from Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep with a story of migration. Some people without legal status are deciding to self-deport, to leave the United States in response to the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Other people are changing where they live within the country. They move from cities with aggressive immigration enforcement to places where they feel more protected. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
A woman who asked that we call her by her first initial, E, recalls the moment she realized it was time to leave. She was at a clothing store in Tampa, Florida. It was her daughter's 15th birthday, and she wanted to buy her an outfit.
Se nos quedaban viendo bien feo.
She felt the salespeople giving them looks, real ugly looks, she says. She told her daughter they could call immigration, and they'll take us. You're an American citizen, but you're also Hispanic. Let's get out of here, she said. The question this family is grappling with is where to.
Quiero volverme a Guatemala. Yo quisiera ya.
He says she wants to go back to Guatemala desperately. Her husband wants to stay in the U.S. So does their daughter. She asks that we only use her first initial because she and her husband are both undocumented. The couple has lived in Tampa, Florida for some 2 decades. Her husband's workplace, a construction site, was recently raided. He just happened to be out that day. And the family knows multiple people who've been deported, including their own church pastor. So they decided to leave Florida for a small town in Michigan. A neighbor friend, also an immigrant, just moved there. She called me recently, E says, and she tells me, why don't you come up here?
Me dijo, aquí está tranquilo, no se oye cosas así, te voy a investigar, me dijo de los trabajos.
Things are quiet here, you don't hear about raids, and I can find you a job, she recalls the neighbor telling her. It's hard to track the movement of undocumented immigrants throughout the U.S. There are no exact numbers. Demographer Matt Brooks at Florida State University studies these population flows, and he says we've been seeing clear trends since at least the 1980s.
There's definitely a pattern. On the aggregate population level, the demographer study, these patterns make a lot of sense.
Brooks says immigrants often land in big cities, but then they make a second move, increasingly to the South or Midwest for jobs in agriculture or manufacturing. And then sometimes there's a third move, away from immigration enforcement, to cities and towns that seem safer.
For example, in 2019, Mississippi, there was the largest single-day immigration raid. We know that immigrants have been leaving Mississippi ever since. So the flow of immigrants out of Mississippi is more than double the flow in.
The Trump administration claims that more than 1.6 million immigrants have self-deported since the president returned to office. But there's also anecdotal evidence that immigrants are relocating within the U.S. to get away from enforcement target areas.
Me fui normal a trabajar y todo, me parqué y todo, y estuve a de cabecear a ver qué.
Over the summer in Omaha, Nebraska, there was a major raid at a meatpacking plant.
Pero mis compañeros.
The morning after, a Salvadoran man, who asked that we refer to him by his first initial, R, because he's worried about his safety as an asylum seeker, sent NPR this audio message. It was 4 a.m. He was sitting in the factory's parking lot, debating whether to go into work or leave Nebraska. He chose to leave.
He manejado 20 horas.
A few days later, R drove nonstop to North Carolina. A friend had told him about a roofing job in a small city where few, if any, immigration raids have taken place. He drove 21 hours straight, drinking coffee and electrolytes. And when he got there, he went straight to work at his new roofing gig. That was 5 months ago. NPR recently checked in with him.
Aquí no.
It's been quiet here, he says. He wouldn't say he's happy, but there are fewer Hispanics, so the place isn't a big immigration enforcement target, at least for now. He's hoping it stays that way. Jasmine Garst, NPR News.
Iran is facing one of its worst droughts in decades. Water levels in dams and rivers are critically low, and Tehran is rationing water. Here's NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam.
The drought gripping Iran has hit virtually every part of the country, affecting jobs, daily life, and certainly the economy. Sajid is a 25-year-old farmer in the southern province of Fars. He asks that we don't use his last name for fear of repercussions from the regime. Sajid says there hasn't been any rain this autumn for the crops.
The authorities don't seem to be doing anything about it. Many villages have been abandoned and people have entirely abandoned their fields. This year has been extremely dry.
The drought has been years in the making. Temperatures are increasingly higher. There's less rainfall or snow, but there's also government mismanagement.
A lot of the irrigation, but also the urban water supply infrastructure in Iran is very outdated, has not been maintained sufficiently.
Suzanne Schmeier is with IHE Delft Institute for Water Education in the Netherlands. She says a large amount of water is lost as it courses through leaky pipes in antiquated infrastructure. Schmeier says there's overconsumption, not only in the cities, but also by farms, because of the Iranian regime's long-standing policy of food self-sufficiency.
It's only 12% of the land in Iran, around 12%, that's being used for agriculture. It only contributes to about 10% of the GDP, but it uses more than 90% of the water.
Schmeier says it would take years of proper technology and governance to reverse the situation, challenging given the international sanctions on Iran. In the meantime, the water shortages in Iran have reached a critical stage. The water pressure in the capital has been reduced during parts of the day to conserve the precious commodity. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian recently warned that Tehran, a city of 10 million, may have to be evacuated. There was widespread skepticism about how that would be implemented. Still, Schmeier says Tehran is in dangerous territory, where the city may soon have to move from less water to prolonged water stoppages. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Clothing prices are ticking up thanks to inflation and tariffs, and more people are saying they don't have to buy new stuff, they'll rent it instead.
I don't really want to hang on to pieces forever. The trends will have changed. My taste might have changed.
I'm Elsa Chang. The rising popularity of clothing rentals on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. It's 529. I'm Heidi Holton. Hope you're having a good Thursday. We've got a lot ahead for you today, including a remembrance of longtime photographer for the Brainerd Dispatch, Steve Coles, passed away this week. Chelsea Perkins will have that story coming up after 8 o'clock. Going on today, you can learn about the Civic Pledge for a Better Minnesota. It's with Majority in the Middle from 10:30 to 11:30 at Rapids Brewing Company in Grand Rapids. The pledge affirms a commitment to reject political violence and foster civic trust. You'll also learn how small actions can lead to meaningful change. Speaking of meaningful change, a lot of folks around the region trying to figure out how they can help their neighbors, especially as SNAP food benefits have gone away. Lots of places are accepting donations or help. Kootaska Community Action has a free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office. They also have a food pantry. It's open from 11 to 2 Monday through Thursday. You can find food resources in your community at our website, kaxe.org. And going on, the Bemidji area's 100 Plus Women Who Care event is tonight at South Shore Hotel on Lake Bemidji. Social hour begins at 5 and the event runs from 6 to 7 p.m. Also going on at 7 o'clock tonight at the Eveleth Auditorium, it's free and open to all. The Mesabi Community Band is presenting a concert for veterans. Let's take a look at the weather around our region. We're expecting sunny skies with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s, light and variable wind with overnight lows in the low 30s. The Northern Lights have been spectacular the last couple of nights. We are continuing to collect your photos. You can text us at 218-326-1234. What we are also collecting are stories. This week, based on a What's for Breakfast conversation on Friday, we're asking about home ec and shop class. Did you have home ec and shop class? What do you remember about it? What projects do you remember? Do you still have them? 218-326-1234. Here's John Latimer and our daily dose of nature.
On today's date, November 13th, in the year 2006, I get a report from a friend who lives on the Sherry's Arm portion of Pakegama Lake of a single common loon hanging out in the waters there. Loons typically migrate a little bit earlier than this, and the adults much earlier than the juveniles. The adults gather on area lakes and fly over to Lake Michigan and spend the couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks in Lake Michigan, and then turn and head south and end up in the Gulf of Mexico after a two-day journey. But the juveniles, and this may have been a juvenile because they are among the last to leave the area, the juveniles take a rather circuitous route to the Gulf of Mexico, one that was radio tagged by a crew that I was part of, spent most of its migration wandering back and forth across the Mississippi River, first Illinois and then Missouri and then back into Kentucky and then across to Louisiana, but finally ending up in the Gulf of Mexico. So these late leaving loons are often juveniles, and given the fact that they have no instructions and no clear pattern, they oftentimes are a bit trepidatious about the trip.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In 2024, President Biden and his party had a problem. They kept saying the economy was the best it had ever been, and many voters weren't feeling that. Democrats lost the election. In 2025, President Trump and his party have the same problem. They keep saying the economy is the best, and many voters aren't feeling it. In polls, voters rank the economy and cost of living as their top concern, and a majority say the president's policies have made things worse. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports on what the White House is trying to do about it.
After sweeping wins by Democrats in last week's elections, where the cost of living was a key issue, President Trump suddenly had a lot to say about affordability.
The affordability is much better with the Republicans. The only problem is the Republicans don't talk about it. And Republicans should start talking about it and use their heads.
But earlier this week, when Laura Ingraham of the Fox News Channel pressed Trump on rising costs of things like coffee and ground beef, he called it a, quote, con job by the Democrats.
And why are people saying they're anxious about the economy? Why are they saying that?
I don't know that they are saying. I think polls are fake. We have the greatest economy we've ever had.
As evidence, Trump points to his tariff policy and pledges by companies and countries to invest in the U.S. And frequently, he talks about the stock market.
We have the greatest economy in our history. We have the highest stock market. All these things are rocking. Inflation is dead. 401ks and retirement accounts just hit an all-time record high. The stock market has set 40-time all-time record highs, and just recently, record high, record high, record high.
But those numbers don't seem to be helping Trump's numbers with voters. People don't want to hear everything is awesome if they are struggling. Jason Furman is a professor of economics at Harvard.
Consumer confidence is near the lowest it's ever been. People are really negative about inflation.
Furman, who served in the Obama administration, says the messaging team in that White House was very cautious not to brag about the economy as the nation emerged from the Great Recession.
Because they thought anything we said positive about the economy risked people thinking President Obama was out of touch. I didn't see that type of reserve when Biden was president. He bragged about it quite a lot. And I think that rung hollow with a lot of people. And President Trump is even less reserved about his bragging.
A senior administration official not authorized to speak on the record tells NPR Trump's domestic travel will pick up soon. And his message will be that while some things have improved, there is more work to do to help people feeling economic strain. The official added that when it comes to affordability, there is no finish line. And in an interview with Fox News yesterday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced relief would be coming soon on some Trump-imposed tariffs that have been driving up grocery prices.
You're going to see substantial announcements over the next couple of days in terms of things we don't grow here in the United States. Coffee being one of them, bananas, other fruits, things like that. So that will bring the prices down very quickly.
Former Trump economic advisor Stephen Moore says there are three major cost issues that have to be addressed: grocery prices, home prices, and health care costs.
It is true, factually, that the average family has more purchasing power today than they did, you know, when Biden left office. And yet people don't feel it. You know, they're not feeling the love. And I can't explain why that is, except that people tend to focus on things where their prices are rising.
He says people are in a crabby mood when it comes to the economy right now. And they get reminders that things are more expensive every time they go to the market or open a power bill. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
If you are in a crabby mood about the economy, it might not be something you want to talk about, especially with family and especially during the holidays. For our Cost of Living series, Life Kit reporter Annie Tagle has some advice on how to start talking dollars and cents.
Maybe you're avoiding bringing up the cost of that big upcoming family trip because you're worried the topic will ruin everyone's Thanksgiving turkey. Here's the thing.
Money is the hidden participant at every dinner table.
Wendy De La Rosa is a behavioral scientist focused on consumers' financial well-being and an assistant professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Like every major life change that we go through, we effectively have to have a money discussion. When someone has a child, right, that comes with a financial burden. When someone gets sick, that comes with a financial burden. When you get married, that comes with a financial transition. When you move countries, when you get a new job.
She says, big or small, it's common for us to lean away from the money side of relationships. Like, you talk for days about baby names, but spend maybe only a few hours on the baby budget. Or
our friend is getting a divorce and we just say, like, how's it going? And we focus on the relationship. But if your friend is getting a divorce, you're probably going through a massive financial change and are just scared of, like, how are they going to manage alone?
But De La Rosa says our financial lives are simply too important to be coy about. So she says, be direct. Talk about money with loved ones openly and honestly and early and often. It's like that idea of loud budgeting. You know that radical notion of being vocal about your financial situation and your goals? For instance, you could just be honest that the reason you're skipping that fancy dinner out with the family this time is your bank balance, not some prior commitment.
There's only X number of dollars in my bank account. You know, I only have X limited amount of attention.
The more forthright you are about your financial life, the more you might encourage everyone around you to do the same, and hopefully, the easier it is to set boundaries and be candid with one another all around. Just because it's the season of giving doesn't mean any one family member should feel like they have to overextend themselves.
I tend to research a lot of underserved communities who, you know, our first instinct is to give. And you just can't set yourself on fire to keep someone else warm.
De La Rosa says, hard though it may be, you should have your own financial house in order before you even think of lending someone else a hand.
We have to recognize that like 40% of Americans like don't have an emergency savings account. And so like off the bat, for a lot of people, whether or not the answer is that they want to, they can't. Because it doesn't make sense to engage in self-sabotaging just because like we feel uncomfortable saying no.
And that doesn't mean you have to say no to everything, she says. There are a lot of other things you can offer, like your time or connections. Or cognitive resources. Whatever you choose, remember, it's okay to want to invest in yourself and in the people who do the same for you, even if they don't always make it an easy process.
Money is complicated. Money is hard. There is no money without relationships. There's no relationships without money. Like, it's so intertwined. And so to all the listeners, it's just have empathy for yourself, have empathy for others. Like, what we're doing is challenging and we're all just trying our best.
For NPR's Life Kit, I'm Andy Tagle.
For more Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to KAXE.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
Good morning. It's 5:43. More news is coming up next from Morning Edition from National Public Radio. We are continuing to hear about things like the Midwest home insurance crisis that is coming from Marketplace right before 6 o'clock. Jeff Sundin is away this week, but we'd love to hear from you. Maybe you are still out there. It was a little cold last weekend. Maybe you're still out on the lakes, making sure you got your gloves and figuring everything out, or maybe you're getting ready for the ice fishing season. If you missed last week's fishing conversation, as Jeff talked about celebrating his 40th season as a fishing guide, it's available at our website right now, kaxe.org. Programming this morning is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with the Good Relatives Collaborative to announce the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees. The Minneapolis Indian Center, Mokoche Agricultural Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. More online at goodrelativescollaborative.org. And we receive support from Clacko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years. The tap room is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday, Saturday, noon to 8, and Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clackobrewing.com.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some amazing Chinese language films are hard to show publicly in China. Not a free society. And that is why some people made plans to show Chinese language films in New York. They planned the Indie China Film Festival to take place right now. Instead, it was canceled last minute. Turns out the movies are hard to screen in America, too. The organizer says he called it off because of Chinese government pressure. Here's NPR's Emily Fang.
Among the films that have been pulled are a stop-motion animated movie about a doll come to life, a documentary about a group of now octogenarian friends who together survived a Chinese gulag in the 1950s, and a documentary about a group of vagrants turned influencers who live under a bridge. The man who was going to screen these films in New York City, Zhu Ruquan, says he has no idea why Chinese security agencies would care about his festival in New York. Zhu describes how just a week before the festival, his own father back in China called him, hinting in very vague terms that something was off. Then people Zhu had worked with in China were contacted by Chinese security agents, warning him not to smear his motherland in any way. And then the cancellation emails started coming in from the directors of the films he was hoping to screen. Zhu showed NPR the approximately 30 cancellation emails. They each contained a curt variation of the same 1 to 2 line message. After deep reflection over personal reasons, each director requested their film be deleted from the festival's lineup, and occasionally they included brief apologies for not being able to attend the festival anymore. Some of the directors live in China. Some live in North America and Europe and the African continent, but all of them have relatives in China. Zhu fears security officials pressured them, just like his own family came under pressure. Ultimately, about 3/4 of the festival's directors bailed, and Zhu just called off the entire event. NPR reached out to the Chinese embassy in Washington for comment, but has not heard back before this broadcast.
It is an example of transnational oppression, and it is in New York City.
This is Yelkin Luyul. He's a China-focused researcher at the advocacy group Human Rights Watch, who looks at how China exerts political pressure on people to change their behavior or to curtail their freedom of speech, even when they are outside of China.
I think it's everybody who does not agree with the Chinese Communist Party central ideology and who challenge Beijing.
And that, Aluyul says, includes art and film. For example, earlier this year, Chinese officials in Thailand pressured an art exhibition there to close because they objected to the artists being shown.
Zhu,
the festival director, says he moved to New York from Beijing because he wanted a less stressful place to live. His documentary work in China meant he'd had to put up with increasing amounts of state surveillance and harassment. An independent film festival he used to run in Beijing became impossible to continue, he says, due to political controls. Coming to New York, he thought he could get these films and the voices behind them heard. Not so, after all. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Still broadcasting freely, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
The government reopens with some surprise extras.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Total Wine and More, offering wines, beers, and spirits for fall celebrations. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. More now on the federal government reopening last night. There is a lot more in that legislation than turning the government back on. For instance, how hemp is regulated. It was tucked into the new farm bill, which was also approved last night. Among hemp's derivatives, textiles and rope, and mind-altering substances. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The new farm bill fixes a loophole, which allowed intoxicating hemp products to be sold nationwide as long as they contained a fairly limited amount of the psychoactive compound THC. Jim Higdon is co-founder of Cornbread Hemp in Louisville, Kentucky. The farm bill puts even stricter THC limits on hemp products, which Higdon says are absurdly low.
So CBD products that people, that adults are taking for pain, anxiety, and sleep issues will become illegal.
Backers of the new farm bill say convenience stores and gas stations were selling intoxicating hemp drinks and vaping products to teens. There are no federal age limits, although some states restrict sales to adults. Higdon says he's fine with a nationwide age requirement, but
we needed guardrails, and what they gave us was a death sentence.
Higdon says if he registered as a state dispensary, he couldn't sell nationwide. That argument doesn't get much support from Chanel Lindsay. She's with the Parabola Center, a think tank of cannabis advocates. She says the hemp industry was taking advantage of a loophole that allowed it to bypass state cannabis laws.
It's improper to have two separate systems where people are, you know, one group is subject to regulations, oversight, regulatory oversight.
and the other is not, she says. The new rules for hemp products won't go into effect until November of next year. Jim Higdon of Cornbread Hemp plans to lobby for changes, but Chanel Lindsay says hemp and cannabis sellers should just band together and push for one national policy for everyone. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Even with the government formally reopened, a lot of flights are still being canceled, with the Transportation Department ordering 6% flights canceled at 40 airports again today. There are just under 1,000 cancellations so far this morning in U.S. airspace, 3% at Chicago, 5% at Newark, for instance. The Walt Disney Company just said it made more profit than expected last quarter, especially from streaming and theme parks. It's increasing its payments back to shareholders, dividends. Disney's stock is down 2.25% in pre-market trading now. S&P futures are down 0.2%. And the pennies you still have are still good, but the last 1 cent coins ever were minted yesterday in Philadelphia. Too expensive, the Trump administration found. McDonald's is among chains giving workers refreshers on how to round cash purchases, and expect more exact change signs in your life.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Time to take the Marketplace Economic Pulse, views from a range of perspectives. We talked to Wall Street economists, but today an economist working at the grassroots to address inequality. Clara Matei is a professor of economics at the University of Tulsa. She's also president of a new grassroots organization in Oklahoma called the Forum for Real Economic Emancipation, or FREE, which tries to reimagine economic and social institutions. Her book from 2022 is about austerity and authoritarianism. In her view, it is austerity now.
Austerity is a word that is not used a lot, but it really cuts to the bone of what is happening in our economic system, which is the fact that the poor are getting poorer because governments and state institutions are shifting resources away from working class people. And it's not about balancing the budget. It's not about acting virtuously to live within our means. It's really about the fact that working people constantly lose because all of their services are taken away from them while the few benefit.
But at a superficial level, I mean, it seems odd to be talking austerity at a time that we're supposed to soon see the stimulus effects of the big budget bill that provided the tax cut coming out of the summer. Are those austere times when this is going to end up in the pockets of some Americans?
I think the issue here is that our current administration is very good at publicizing what seems to be actually in favor of people, while deep down what is happening is that those who live off of dividends, rent, and interest pay far less taxes than those who are actually living off of a wage.
I mean, President Trump the other day was talking about sending $2,000 tariff dividends out to people. There seems to be a sense in the administration of getting some money out to people that doesn't sound all that austere.
This is a conversation Trump has to put out there to avoid losing completely its base, a base that is clearly struggling economically like never before. You know, 77% of American workers are in trouble if their paycheck is delayed by 1 week. If people did get a lot in their paychecks, like the COVID money, we know were enough to get people kind of empowered a little, they resigned, they were unionizing. So social resources may empower people to a degree by which they might not want to participate in wage labor and exploitation.
Give us a sense of this newish grassroots organization that you're part of, the Forum for Real Economic Emancipation. It's early days. Are you like listening to the grassroots now, or are you emerging with a kind of plan of action yet?
You know, I'm here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. People in this city that really represent the hardship, right? Feel the thirst for knowledge that's actually critical. So what the FREE does is provide a space for dialogue through council meetings and also public events. And we're doing one a month. Our next one is going to be on food sovereignty. So who controls the food, I think, is more than ever a timely question. And hopefully start a pilot program to say, let's see if we can actually break from market dependence and pressure potentially also the local institutions to switch the logic once more in favor of need, not of profit.
Carla Matei is president of this grassroots organization called the Forum for Real Economic Emancipation. She's also a professor of economics at the University of Tulsa. Thank you very much.
It was wonderful talking to you, David, as always. Thank you.
Taking the marketplace economic pulse, views on the economy from a wide range of perspectives here. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
We've been listening to Morning Edition from National Public Radio. It's here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton with Kari Hedlund. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We'll be talking throughout our morning about Northern Lights, of course, and reading, what books you might be reading. I'm still working on, I'm kind of savoring the latest Louise Penny. Love to hear from you this morning, 218-326-1234. We receive support from Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, helping guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, more at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Thank you so much for your support. It's 6 o'clock.
Good morning. Doc.